Under the general theme of knowledge upon knowledge, I have subtitled this portion of my remarks, The First 1,000 Days. I do so with some anxiety, realizing that phrase has also been used to mark the public service of both Anne Boleyn and John F. Kennedy. But I won't ask you your wishes on a second 1,000 days if you won't ask me mine. We should move quickly past the title in any case, lest we seem to be focusing too much on one of Brother Cleon Skousen's titles. I do intend, however, that my remarks will have relevance to our theme chosen from the 42nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. If thou shalt ask, thou shalt receive revelation upon revelation, knowledge upon knowledge, that which bringeth joy, that which bringeth life eternal. It goes without saying that I'm thrilled to have all of you together under one roof for at least 1 hour or so once a year. No assignment I face, difficult as many of them are, brings with it the anguish and anxiety and earnest hope that this one always does. This is our fourth such conference together, and I've always prayed they would be worthwhile and uplifting to you. I have so prayed again through the night and this morning. You mean everything to me. You are the university that I love. You make it what it is. You are the key to what it will be. Thank you for the bright hope another year together holds for all of us. I'm grateful for the staff and administrative support that is so faithfully given at this university. Except in settings like this, we seldom get to pay adequate appreciation to the legion who make our central instructional mission possible. This morning, I will be speaking again about the educational destiny of this university. I do not apologize for that. We talk about academic life at BYU for the same reason they talk about automobiles at General Motors. This is a wonderful setting, however, in which to say to the entire support structure of the university that we love you, that we could not fill our educational tasks without you, and that you are invited, every one of you, all of us, to see our work as an integral part of and a direct link to the learning environment of this university. Everyone counts here. Everyone matters. If George Herbert saw that a 17th century maiden's sweeping of the floor could be performed with such purity and devotion that it became an offering unto God, then we can do no less, especially at this university, in saluting the faithful devotion of the marvelous support structure of the university, brothers and sisters, so crucial to our success, who trim the shrubs, type the words, stoke the furnace, and compute the numbers. Please know that we love you one and all. As I speak this morning of our ongoing educational challenge, I pay the compliment of including everyone in the room in that challenge. When I arrived on campus in August of 1980, we set for ourselves a timetable for reviewing, at least in a very general way, the health of the university. We guessed that any less than frenzied look would probably take 3 years to complete. And although we haven't quite made the complete loop, this conference does mark the end of that three-year period. Consequently, I feel I owe you something of a stewardship report about what I've found and what I'm feeling as anything we could call a beginning to this administration comes to a close. To cover 36 months in 36 minutes is to deftly blend superficiality with tedium, but then those are two of my great strengths. If you will bear with me in a report I really do feel I owe you, I promise never again to inflict quite this same State of the Union approach on you again. So without suggesting that announcements are synonymous with accomplishments, may I list very briefly some of the things we've learned and some of the things we've been trying to do in a long initial look at the university. Unfortunately, what time constraints force me to omit may be more telling than the things I can include. I began work about 7:30 in the morning on Friday, August 1st, 1980, officially. By 2:30 in the afternoon, I was trapped, literally, physically trapped in my office, the door barred by two parents who had driven all night to ask me why their son could not be admitted to BYU. They would not leave, and I could not. So we talked at some length, on and off, for several days. That was a sobering introduction to a university that has historically admitted virtually every student who has applied. I came here accepting the reality of an enrollment ceiling as a fact of life, an inevitable page in our history, which we could turn to our advantage if we were given the inspiration to do it. I knew that whatever else it would do, it would force us to address the quality of the institution in a way we might not have the courage to do otherwise. I am very proud to say that with such an emotional and difficult admissions task, one in which we are expected to be all things to all people, we have, at least for a time, made a very successful beginning. We have drafted, reviewed, shared with you, re-reviewed, and finally had approved by the Commissioner's Office and the Board of Trustees what I believe is a very enlightened and, for us, still blessedly flexible admissions program. We have made clear our expectations, offered our help toward meeting those expectations, and will now reward the student who demonstrates that he or she really cares about coming to BYU. We hope that group will always represent a broad economic and geographic cross-section of the church's membership. In any case, our obligation to do the most we can for the largest group possible has certainly been enhanced by an important step forward in our admissions philosophy. At the same time, but in much less visible ways, we have pursued important refinements within the university offering itself. What should such increasingly prepared students find here? College by college, department by department, often course by course review, has helped us attractively hone an academic offering which is now emerging from a somewhat bloated curriculum. Scores of courses have been eliminated, along with specialties within majors and a surprising menagerie of subspecialties within majors. Furthermore, we've combined some graduate degrees, eliminating or furloughing others, focusing our energy and our talent on the things we really can and should do superbly well. This is not the kind of review that makes headlines in the church news, but it drew applause from the Board of Trustees when I gave a progress report there. We ought, like Cassius, to have a slightly lean and hungry look in our curriculum, suggesting, though in some less malignant way, that we too really do mean business. We salute deans, department chairmen, and faculty who've been willing to subsume personal preference and special interest to do the best thing by the university as a university. We've also found it wise to create a university information system, which should help keep us abreast of the vast technological swirl that, when affordable and mastered, can help us be more effective in many newly remarkable ways. I confess that for me, the bloody handwriting was on the wall when not just the faculties of engineering, technology, management, and law were bolstering their banks of bits and bytes, but when finally the College of Humanities, the last great bastion of the feathered quill, succumbed. With Mephistopheles smirking over a pile of floppy disks, Faust is this very hour selling his soul via high-speed data entry right here on BYU campus, a church university nestled in the shadows of the everlasting hills. Assuming by that modest milestone that nothing is sacred anymore, we at least intend to be as adept at such electronic wizardry as we can be. Ohne Hast, aber ohne Rast. At least some of you will know we have tried to give increased significance to continuing faculty status and advancement in rank. Undoubtedly, some have been disappointed at the department, college, or university review level. We know there are some areas within the university where professional accomplishment is not easily quantifiable in traditional ways. We acknowledge that. We are giving our support to resolving such difficulties. But I think everyone agrees that given the very painful faculty limitations we face over the next 25 years, we have no choice but to expect the very best from every one of us. Such reviews are at least one way to give us a point of reference regarding that expectation. I'm very pleased with some developments we've seen over these first 36 months in the area of student life. I'm encouraged by an emerging philosophy that suggests student life and student government do not simply mean outsized junior high election campaigns and endless debates over special seats in the Marriott Center. I have felt that our leaders and advisors there are genuinely trying to share with the students an enlarged vision of their opportunity here. In our own response to that, we've added to the Faculty Advisory Council and the Administrative Advisory Council a Student Advisory Council, and we have told these young people we will take them as seriously as they take their university opportunity. An important ancillary expression of our student focus will be seen for the first time this weekend in a greatly expanded new student orientation program involving the Academic Vice President's Office, Admissions and Records, the alumni, as well as student life. Many of our support areas of the university will also be involved in accommodating between 4,000 and 6,000 new freshmen and transfer students, plus many of their parents. In addition to our involvements, Friday through Tuesday, Pat and I will be meeting all who wish to come to our home on Saturday afternoon. We want them to know that their principal opportunities will be in the classrooms and the libraries and the laboratories. We are trying to stress that fact in new ways as well as old. But we also hope that student-centered services and activities out of class will enhance the learning experience through significant leadership opportunities and the examination of verbalized values measured against demonstrated behavior, a confrontation with virtus et veritas, if you will. Needless to say, we could not even open the doors of the university to that kind of personal effort if it were not for the incomparable service of 14 LDS stakes and 140 campus wards to every one of you who contribute to that special and irreplaceable ingredient in student life. We give our deepest thanks. I'm especially pleased in these first 36 months with the course we see being taken by our three campus-wide educational components: general education, honors education, and religious education. Largely through the inestimable service of our Faculty General Education Council and the work of Deans Bill Evanson, Don Jarvis, and their administrative associates, we have begun to see a general education climate where that much-needed educational opportunity itself can be the object of our energy and our attention rather than which kind of GE program will provide or measure it. Our current effort is still far from perfect. There will always be need to discuss better ways to go about it, but I thank all who have, over what are now decades, helped us get to this point. Certainly, I thank the faculty for making this program work, because heaven only knows there is no way an administration could make it succeed simply by our pronouncing that it must. I am delighted with the superb work done by so many, especially Dean Gary Browning and his immediate associates, in opening up the honors opportunity to anyone who wishes to accept personal responsibility for such an excellent education. It seems to me we have cut through the criticisms, many of them justified, about elitism and clubbiness in the honors program, without yielding on the rigor and expectations that are made there for those who wish the experience. I love the basic premise that any student, my daughter or your son, can take a degree with honors at BYU if she or he is willing to pay the price in labor and learning that is required. And as the administrative baton is passed to Deans D. Lamar Jensen, Tom Brown, and Bill Bradshaw, we anticipate a very exciting new era in honors education. We welcome D. Lamar back from his mission presidency in Peru and thank him for his willingness to serve in this very important position. We're grateful for Tom's continued recovery from very sudden and very serious surgery. Bill gave willing service earlier than was fair to ask of him, but which was very important in Dean Jensen's absence. The most important campus-wide program in our curriculum is religious education. For some time, we have wanted to be of more assistance in the professional development of both the full-time and the out-of-college faculty who teach these courses. We acknowledge that in so many ways, their external opportunities for professional development are severely limited. Internally, we hope that those teachers selected from across campus to teach these courses will take advantage of the very significant new in-service opportunities that Brother Reynolds and Dean Matthews and their associates in religious education have helped to create. We are paying very good money to provide such an incentive to do so, and our justification is, of course, that this preparation will have its impact in the classroom. There has been some talk stemming from this that all religion courses would eventually be taught from across campus faculty. That is not so, though we always want a very healthy, eager participation from the very best teachers in virtually every department on the campus. The mix of full-time to out-of-college teachers is probably about right at present, roughly 50-50, though that may vary a little in any given semester. And we hope, as they join forces, that both full-time and transfer colleagues will consider this the most important teaching of their professional lives. As good as it now is, the very nature of the responsibility demands that we have a better, broader, deeper commitment to the quality of religious education on our campus. A student's developing faith and nascent understanding of the gospel must be bolstered and fortified by superb teachers who are themselves examples of spirituality and scholarship in the best tradition of Brigham Young University and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Having lived and learned for 1,000 days, I hope to be turning a larger portion of my personal time and attention to making religious education a stronger hub for the BYU wheel. That requires higher vision, better effort, and more personal and professional goodwill from every one of us at the university. And now is the time to see that effort blossom. I wish to commend publicly the work of a very dedicated advisory committee on women's concerns, consisting of 10 very able men and women from our BYU family. As part of our administrative beginning, I asked them where we were and where we ought to be on what are conveniently called women's issues, but which seem to me to be human issues. After a great deal of work, they have recently submitted this very substantial report, which is broad in its scope and very precise in its detail. We have begun our discussion of its recommendations, and I will meet with that council periodically to evaluate our progress. As I have looked into our policies and measured them against some parts of our performance, it strikes me that, again, that women's issues or minority issues or affirmative action issues are at heart Christian issues, matters for the most part dealing simply with gospel standards of equity and fairness and courtesy and dignity. Without claiming victories we haven't earned, we nevertheless do see some improvements. I quote from the advisory committee's report. We acknowledge the progress made in the increased enrollment of women in non-traditional areas of study. The positive portrayal of women in BYU publications and the increased visibility of women in university assemblies of several kinds provides an improved image of women on this campus. Currently, 19% of the administrative positions on our campus are held by women, which is consistent with the percentage of administrative women on other university campuses. Since 1971, there has been an increase of 7.4% in the administrative positions held by women, with a 1.7% increase in this past year alone. Furthermore, 50% of the women who became administrators between 1977 and 1982 were promoted from staff positions. Well, there is more we can and should do at every level of the university, and we know that. Regarding the education of women, may I simply quote briefly from a much longer letter I recently sent a concerned alumnus. Our church leaders have consistently taught that the highest priority for mothers who have young children in the home should be the companionship and training of those children and the care of their families. That is our unequivocal position as well. It is also true in recent years that our church leaders have expressed increasing concern about the special needs of our adult single members, particularly women. More than 25% of the current adult membership of the church are women who have never married or who are widowed, divorced, or separated. We cannot assume that all women students will marry, remain married, be physically able to bear children, or through death of a spouse, avoid the need to be self-sustaining. Women's primary orientation toward motherhood is not inconsistent with their diligent pursuit of an education. According to current life expectancy, a 20-year-old woman can look forward to more than 50 additional years of life. Not all of that time will be spent in bearing children and raising families. From one-third to one-half of a woman's remaining years of life will be spent in activities preceding marriage and the rearing of children, or following the time when children have left home. We believe a woman's education should prepare her for the responsibility of marriage, motherhood, and whatever other tasks may come to her. It should prepare her for the entire period of her life. One of our clearly stated goals at Brigham Young University is to assist individuals in their quest for perfection and eternal life. We are concerned about and committed to the growth and perfection of all our Heavenly Father's children. I should say at this point that any part of my information about how we've been doing in our varied and sundried parts of the university has often had nothing at all to do with any formal review process. It comes by mail. I have here this morning a sheaf of letters ranging from the woman in Christie's Beach, South Australia, who felt that the young ambassadors gave her son true pride in being a Latter-day Saint for the first time since he entered a very difficult phase of his high school experience there, to letters about the crew who fought floods first out of Rock Canyon and then out of the Marriott Center, to the courteous treatment a family received in our benefits office when there had been a serious illness at home, to the overtime service by those in the graduate office who managed to pull order out of a student's chaos, To the personal kindness of faculty members this morning, including at least Gary Buse, Don Norton, Phil Coombs, Hugh Baird, Clayne Pope, Milt Backman, Raleigh Bester, and on and on. Now, don't rush out and invite students and family to write the president. That isn't really the point. I simply salute all of you through the correspondence regarding a few for making this a beautiful place to be. As one elderly lady wrote following her brief visit on campus, "To say I was impressed at BYU is too inadequate. It is a beautiful campus in the loveliest of settings, but that is inadequate as well. The difference at BYU is your people. I don't know specifically what your goals are there, but I am certain you are meeting them because of the people who serve there." Amen to that. The success stories which don't get written about or mentioned, but about which I know, also go on and on. They are wonderfully impressive, running through virtually every college, department, service, and agency on this campus. Without going into the detail I did in our administrator's workshop last spring, let me simply say that the relationship among our vice presidents and all the areas and personnel they represent has been so mutually supportive that I find us able to address the high priorities of the university in a most remarkable way. We've lengthened our own budget planning process from a 3-month calendar to a 9-month calendar, the effect of which has been to bring considerably better discussion about our real purposes and our real needs. I thank everyone in the room for that increasingly effective use of resources, because in a very real way, every one of you has contributed. I publicly commend Presidents Baloff, Kerr, Smith, and Schwendeman for their leadership in this important collegial attitude represented at every level of their respective units. Now, speaking of resources and opportunities to improve the quality of our work, I am delighted to report on the very encouraging success we are having in our Excellence in the 80s campaign. I had intended to show you a film strip. I think the pressures of time this morning would not suggest that that is wise, but it is the kind of film strip you'll have, I think, several opportunities to see. It's a film strip marvelously well prepared to tell the BYU story, and we'll simply find opportunities to share that with you in the months and even years ahead for our campaign. But I would at least like to turn to some slides, if I can ask for that assistance in the booth. As these slides indicate, we have had 24-month total in our campaign. From the starting date until the end of 1981, a 4-month period, a little over $5 million was raised. From January through December of 82, over $19 million was raised. And from January of this year through August, $11.5 million has been raised, for a total of $36 million, the most successful 24-month fundraising period, obviously, in the history of Brigham Young University. In other words, we are on track with the campaign, because with 37.5% of the campaign period elapsed, we have raised 36% of our $100 million goal in a very difficult economic period. Based on this performance, we are more than confident that we will be past $100 million by January of 1986. You might be interested in this third slide, which simply shows where and how those gifts have come. I'm not sure we need to detail them, but we list nearly $3 million in unrestricted cash, over $14 million in restricted cash. We're not getting that slide. $4 million in securities, $4.5 million in real property, nearly $500,000 in art, nearly $5 million in what we simply call other, to cover a miscellany of things, and then $5 million in deferred gifts. We thank our development staff. We thank all who work on our committees for that remarkable success. That, too, seems like the kind of thing it's only fair to share with you as we move into this campaign. We are having, I confess, considerably more success than I thought we could have in the early going. Obviously, we need a certain momentum in this, and I assume the gifts will be hitting something of a peak at about the 5-year mark and beyond. But to be within a percentage point of our success, even in these first 24 months, I think is a wonderful tribute to those who have worked so hard, and so many of you are doing that. And again, I say we'll show you later the film strip that we might have shown at this hour. Let me conclude this stewardship report to you with the plainest of triangles. If I had a Marriott Center-sized chalkboard, I would draw one for you. It is a simple, sturdy, geometrical figure, and virtually everything we've tried to do in these first few months can be represented by it. The long, prominent, solid base of this imaginary triangle is our faith. I stress long and prominent and solid because I suppose in that sense this is an isosceles rather than an equilateral triangle. Rising up to an apex out of either side of that base are our other two essential university characteristics of scholarship and teaching. Faith, scholarship, teaching. The three things we must provide if our students are to find the virtue and truth I have tried to speak to them so publicly about. May I comment briefly on these three in reverse order? Of necessity, I speak of them separately, but I do not think they are separable in a truly integrated BYU life. Teaching is quite simply the noblest profession of which I can conceive. That probably is no surprise. Indeed, what we know about the human soul makes teaching a sacred, even a holy endeavor. In so speaking, I do not wish to demean the language. I wish to elevate the profession. And as I said earlier, I include everyone in the room in that profession, broadly defined. Much of our teaching at BYU is good. An increasing portion of it is excellent. But some of it is absolutely appalling. I ask each one of us to give renewed attention to the effectiveness of our instruction, its style and its substance and its significance. Many professional studies indicate that our effectiveness will decline from as early as our 35th birthday. That simply must not be the case in a BYU classroom. We ought to improve our profession, and I repeatedly use that word literally. We ought to improve in our profession every year of our lives. Now, we're talking a good deal more about scholarship these days in our triangled world at BYU. That is for one very good and simple reason. We are not likely ever to be the great university God would have us be without it. Our teaching and our faith have to be informed and enhanced by an eager sense of personal progress in our respective disciplines. Notes used in class 5 years ago simply aren't good enough today. I'd like to suggest that notes used in class 5 months ago are probably not good enough today. Publications that dropped off after our dissertations had been mined speak volumes about professional vitality. I commend to every one of us the attitude toward learning that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and Spencer W. Kimball have had. We will have neither powerful teaching nor fortified faith without it. Now about faith. What I wish to say here is very personal to our purposes at BYU. It is off the record to the press, if they are present. It is for our internal consideration only. I have yet to decide whether these particular remarks will be printed. My greatest prayer is not to be misunderstood and to help, not hinder, the spirit of this day and of this year. It is no startling revelation to acknowledge that this is a difficult time in the church, but then the church has had other, far more difficult times. Some of the brethren, including two members of the First Presidency, are struggling with failing health and the relentless toll of age. Heavy loads are being carried by men who, in the normal walks of life, would have been enjoying retirement 10 or 20 or in some cases 30 years ago. President Kimball is 88, and our beloved recently deceased LeGrand Richards was active in his post in his 97th year. The faithfulness of such brethren, their wives and their families, is a study in sacrifice and patience and perseverance. But as President Gordon B. Hinckley said in our last general conference, he the baby of the presidency at 75, God is weaving his tapestry according to his grand design. All flesh is in his hands. This is his work. He will not permit it to fail. No, the difficulty of the times is not with the health of the brethren. It is with those who are not as inclined towards such faithful sacrifice and service in the kingdom. The difficulty is with those increasingly hostile in their opposition to the church and its purposes. As we grow in size and significance, I am sure that opposition will increase, not decrease. We all have cause to consider what it means to defend the kingdom of God. And what does it mean for BYU as a whole? No metaphor seems more apt than the lines from Martin Luther, which Professor Jean England shared with the honor students last spring. I quote, "The kingdom of God is like a besieged city surrounded on all sides by death. Each man has his place on the wall to defend, and no one can stand where another stands. But nothing prevents us from calling encouragement to one another." I think the brethren are seeing a good deal of death very near the gates of the city these days, and perhaps they fear they will see more. Certainly they have a view of such matters neither you nor I can have. In any case, I think they hope to hear a call of encouragement from our side of the fortress, encouragement that we too are at work in defending the faith. They do not intend to tell us what to do or how to do our work. There is no inclination on their part to dot our intellectual I's and cross our scholarly T's. But in a time of battle and bullets, they would like to be reassured that our guns are not trained on them. With all that he has to do, and in the loneliness only he can fully comprehend just now, no less a man than President Hinckley, a gifted, erudite, scholarly man in his own right, and one committed to education with all his heart, this weary man, the chairman of our executive committee and the only acting officer of our board, felt the need to give this call recently from his truly unique position in the kingdom. Speaking at the BYU Hawaii commencement exercises just 2 months ago, he said to our colleagues and students there, "May I refer to a matter concerning the church? We now seem to have a great host of critics. Some appear intent on trying to destroy us. They mock that which is sacred. They belittle that which we call divine. Some have said that we are trapped by our history. Others have worked with great diligence to seek out flaws in our early leaders. We're accused of being opposed to intellectualism." These are serious accusations against a church which teaches that the glory of God is intelligence, or in other words, light and truth. These are serious charges against an institution which each year spends millions of dollars of its resources on the education of its youth. These people who are our critics have lost sight of the glory and wonder of this work. In their cultivated fault-finding, they see not the majesty of a great onrolling cause. They have lost sight of the spark that was kindled in Palmyra and is now lighting fires of faith across the earth in many lands and in many languages. We recognize that our forebears were human. They doubtless made mistakes. They acknowledged making mistakes. But the mistakes were minor compared with the marvelous work which they accomplished. To highlight the mistakes and gloss over the greater good is to draw a caricature. Caricatures are amusing, but they're often ugly and dishonest as well. A man may have a wart on his cheek and still have a face of beauty and strength. But if the wart is emphasized unduly in relation to his other features, the portrait is lacking in integrity. "There was only one perfect man who ever walked the earth," he concludes. "The Lord has used imperfect people in the process of building his perfect society. If some of them occasionally stumbled, or if their characters may have been slightly flawed in one way or another, the wonder is the greater that they accomplished so very much. My plea to you is that as you continue your search for truth, that you look for strength and goodness, rather than weakness and foibles in those who did so great a work in their time." Close quote. This is where I need help. In light of that plea from our file leader, I feel obligated to say this much about our institutional obligation to our sponsoring church. It is amazing to me how little the church really asks of BYU. In fact, they ask almost literally nothing. We wash the linen at the missionary training center and mow the lawn at the temple. For that, we get more than $100 million in appropriation every year to run the university. Not a bad arrangement. With only one string attached. Through good days and bad, through old issues or new, the brethren desire just one thing from us, to know that we are their allies in the battle to save souls. They really ask for not one thing more than that in return for all we've been given again this year here. I think such reassurance is not too much for them to ask. As broad and diverse and curious as we all are, and always have been, we shall surely have greatly differing opinions about many things. We ought to have. We are encouraged to have. That is the nature of a university. Indeed, we might on occasion have differences of opinion with our trustees. I have had differences with them. But I haven't written any books about it, and I haven't gone on TV to proclaim it. So far, fortunately, they haven't written any books about me. Consequently, doors have remained open, and there have been ways to discuss very complex matters and learn from them together. Now, if we can be respectful of their ever more difficult task, and if we will call out encouragement from our place on the wall, any difference we will ever have is resolvable, and the work of the university continues. You see, I have gambled my entire administrative stance at BYU on one single solitary proposition: that we could be an excellent university, indeed truly a great university, an educational Mount Everest, if you will, and still be absolutely, unequivocally firm in the faith of the gospel of Jesus Christ and loyal to his church which sponsors us. I have said to every prospective faculty member joining us that we will be great, but only because of our religious heritage, never, never in spite of it. Everything I have done from my first hour on this campus has been to present and exalt that one proposition, the greatness of this university, coupled with the firmness of its faith. All I have done has been to exalt that proposition in any way I could. I have said it to you, I've said it to the students, I have said it to our alums, and above all, I have said it to the trustees. Now, frankly, in light of four centuries of what started out to be Christian higher education, but didn't stay that way, not everyone has believed it could be done. But that was pre-Palmyra, and this is BYU. And so I have put all my administrative eggs in one basket and again said it can be done. And I have also said that this was the generation of BYU faculty members at BYU who could do it. So, anyone feeling compelled to work at embarrassing the brethren over matters of church doctrine or history or governance should not plan to do it here. We have too much at stake. Too much has been given by far too many for more than a century of struggle to allow even one or two to casually foul the BYU nest and fly on. What is at stake is the very idea of a transcendently true university. A work here that has scarcely even begun. Excuse me. There are few earthly things more beautiful than a university. They give to the young their impressionable years, a bond of the lofty purpose shared, of a great corporate life, whose links will not be loosed until they die, and here will not be loosed when they die. They give young people that close companionship for which youth longs, and that chance for the endless discussion of the things which are endless, without which youth would seem a waste of time. There are few earthly things more splendid than a university. In these days of broken frontiers and collapsing values, when the dams are down and the floods are making misery, when every future looks somewhat grim and every ancient foothold has become something of a quagmire, wherever a university stands, it stands and shines. Wherever it exists, the minds of men, urged on to full and fair inquiry, may still bring wisdom into human affairs. Now that's from John Masefield in the shadow of World War II in Great Britain. And he didn't know anything about BYU or the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. If he can say that about the University of Sheffield when choices had to be made in England, then I'd like to invite you to think about what might be said of BYU when choices have to be made here. I use it specifically because these two are days of broken frontiers and collapsing values when the dams are down and floods are making history. In the midst of last spring's Temple Drive aqueduct, we had some administrative flooding of our own. Probably doesn't surprise you. And I said to President Baliff, "Jay, we surely seem to spend a lot of our time sandbagging. It is just one damn thing after another." Little play on words. No, don't. "We are forever trying to put one more finger in the dike." Jay said, "Yes, and I yearn for the day when we're simply on higher ground." Well, so do I. Then if the floods come, they come. If the dams break, they break. But BYU will be on higher ground. We simply cannot afford to be like every other university on the face of the earth. We want to know all they know, but we know some other things besides. And then when every future looks grim and every ancient foothold has become a quagmire, Brigham Young University will stand and shine, and it will matter in the minds of men. Well, so much for a triangle. I was only going to mention briefly. Thank you for letting me share with you what must of necessity be a shared sense of responsibility for this university's future. I wish to close today by sharing with you a glimpse into the lives of two students. I am in hopes such a glimpse will reinforce my inadequate comments on faith, on scholarship, and on teaching. In some ways, these two students are very different from each other and are very different from the rest of the student body. On the other hand, they are virtually indistinguishable from the 26,000 who now await us just outside these doors next week. The one thing they have in common this morning is their relationship with the Holland family. It is because of personal friendship that I have imposed on them, and because of personal friendship that they've agreed to be visual aids. They provide a commentary on knowledge upon knowledge for our second 1,000 days. Garrett, would you please stand up for a moment? In fact, stay standing till I tell you to sit down. Garrett Muse is a hometown boy. He's the son of Ivan Muse in our secondary education department and his wife Joanne. Both Ivan and Joanne are BYU alums, and it is no surprise Garrett is attending here. He's a sophomore, a returned missionary, and he hopes someday to teach at a college somewhere. Garrett is, like so many others, working his way through school. He does so as part of the BYU grounds crew, and his assignment includes the grounds near the president's home. All summer long, my 9-year-old son David has tagged Garrett around his assignment. They've talked about science and what makes firecrackers explode. They've talked about Indians who lived in Utah County long before there was a BYU. They've talked about why there's an American fork and a Spanish fork. They've talked about presidents of the United States, and they've talked about football. They've talked about the world of books and how much experience can be condensed into a few well-written pages. Garrett has invited Duff to read The K, about a boy who goes blind and learns that black and white are just colors, and that in the dark we're all the same. He recommended, call it courage, for times when fear might be great and could be faced and overcome. My son has now read both books this summer. They've talked about character and integrity and personal values, about honesty and clean speech and the word of wisdom. Garrett remembered that he was about Duff's age when he set some personal goals for himself, and that observation was not lost on my boy. And they've talked about the terrible dilemma of war and why it is sometimes necessary, but how tragic the cost always is. They've talked about living and dying for principle, deciding that life without principle isn't much of a life at all. They've agreed that it is worth it to try and be a peacemaker, as difficult as that task always is. They've talked of such things from the scriptures, about the anti-Nephi Lehis who could not fight lest they offend their God, and of their 2,000 stripling sons who did fight in defense of their parents' honor. And through it all, my son listened for hours on end, helping with a rake, pulling up a weed, spading for a few new plants, and then he spoke of it all to his dad when he tucked him in at night. Now ask me what is special about Brigham Young University. I am not smug enough to suggest that other young men and women working in on some other presidential ground somewhere would be less exemplary role models or indeed instructors for a 9-year-old boy, but I've got my own opinion about the chances of that. I thank Garrett Muse for being what almost all BYU students are, or at least what I think they want to be. I thank him not as an administrator, but as a father. And I hope he does pursue a career in teaching, since he does so much of it so well right now. He is only a sophomore, and we owe him a lot more knowledge. But he, like every other student, brings to us knowledge in his own right, and he has brought absolute joy to my son in the process. That is what the sharing of vital knowledge does, and that is the marvelous privilege we have once again as school year 1983 begins. Thank you, Garrett. Brother Choi, would you please stand? Dong S. Choi is in some ways as unlike Garrett Muse as it is possible to be. He is older. He is married with a fine family. He was not raised in Utah County, and until 24 months ago had never heard of the LDS Church or BYU. But across years and miles and anguish and culture, Dong is in other ways very much like Garrett and the rest of our 26,000. He too is a student at BYU, and with his family is a fellow ward member with the Hollands in the Oak Hills 4th Ward. The Presbyterian Church is the largest Christian denomination in Korea. There are 7 million members in South Korea alone, which makes one out of every 5 persons in that country a Presbyterian. The chairman and principal figure of that large and important Christian community is the Reverend M. H. Choi, Dong Choi's father. Here today is his son, the ecclesiastical heir apparent, if you will, raised in that absolutely orthodox Presbyterian home, himself an ordained minister, and at a very early age, a professor of theology in several seminaries and universities in Seoul, teaching there for over 10 years. From our culture, the closest analogy I can draw is to suggest that you see before you the son of Billy Graham. And through his early life, like his fathers before him, he taught strongest of all against the Mormon heresy. In quotes. But then one day he met Mormon missionaries on a street. Young men very much like Garrett Muse, one of whom is currently a student at BYU, and they began to talk. They talked every day for 6 months, this professor of Hebrew and Greek and world religions with his 2 young 19-year-old friends. And he found that in spite of their innocence and ignorance, they had stunning, world-shattering answers. At least they were shattering to his world regarding the most troublesome of Christian doctrines, foremost of which for him were modern revelation, salvation for the dead, and the queen of John Calvin's concerns, predestination. May I quote from his own expression of this pivotal moment in his life? As I came to realize that the LDS Church was indeed the only true church, the pressure on me was overwhelming. At each point, as each point became clear and as understanding came into my mind, the turmoil within me naturally increased. How could I continue in a ministry when I was convinced that the doctrine I had to teach was not right? Yet I was trained for the ministry because of my father. My whole life had been involved with the ministry. As it became more evident that a change would have to come soon, that agony increased. I was part of a societal pattern with strong Confucian concepts. Strong filial piety, the idea of honoring my parents, was very deeply embedded in me. To leave the ministry was to go directly against the wishes of my father. What was I to do? Moreover, how was I going to make a living should I leave the ministry? There was no peace in my heart, only turmoil and untold agony. For my own mental and spiritual well-being, I had to make a decision. And in the final analysis, I knew I had to be honest with myself, no matter what the ultimate cost may be. Well, that cost has been high. I did not know how high it would prove to be. The persecution and suffering I have received from my relatives and my friends following my conversion are beyond my ability to tell. And of course, former faculty members, even loving students, look upon me as a heretic. I left the campus in disgrace, at least in their eyes. I found occasional part-time work to sustain myself and my family. But to make a long and very painful story short, he concludes, I am now a member of the Restored Church of Jesus Christ. I'm also reduced to the status of a struggling graduate student trying to make ends meet. After all these years, it is an interesting position that I find myself in, struggling to pay my rent and my utilities. But through it all, I know that I made the right decision. My wife and children have paid a great price for accepting what we know to be true. We have lost much in the process, but we have gained more than we ever dreamed of. There is an inner peace and genuine joy in my heart that comes from a knowledge of the truth. Thank you, Tom. Knowledge upon knowledge. What do we owe the Garrett Muses and Dong Choi's in our 1983 student body? What of their dreams and their goodness and their sacrifice? Have our faith and our scholarship and our teaching prepared us to truly bless their lives with knowledge upon knowledge? Well, to Garrett and to Dong and 26 others, I give a resounding yes to that question. And I say to them, there is no group anywhere in this world to whom I could more joyfully commend you than this audience this morning at the start of another school year. There is no family like the BYU family anywhere on the face of this globe. Which suggests my closing line. 1 week ago yesterday, I arose early after a restless night with many concerns on my mind and in my heart. I prepared myself for an important meeting with our executive committee of the board on matters I thought of absolutely crucial importance to the university as we started a new year. I wondered how best to say what needed to be said and how to find agreement on complex issues. I prayed earnestly, and I thought I alone had difficult problems to resolve. Then sometime that morning, I realized that Sabra Peterson was arising early after a restless night and with many concerns on her mind and in her heart, was preparing herself to speak at Elwood's funeral. What we mean to each other here at BYU, at that moment, rushed into my heart as a mighty wind with cloven tongues as of fire, to quote St. Luke. This university and the life and love we have together here is a blessing beyond my ability to express or measure. Our differences, even in a particularly difficult time, are as nothing when compared to our very special bond. How much that bond really means is now known best of all to people like Stu Groh and Jim Barton and Gardner Snow and Elwood Peterson, who with other of our colleagues and their partners have this year added knowledge to their knowledge. May we, faculty, staff, students, and administrators, increase our commitment to truths that will not only make this the finest school year ever, ever, but that will ultimately take us to our eternal home, I pray, in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.